Chapter 12. Of his companions. But they represented his last means of access to the world, a kind of subterranean channel on which he could set his statements afloat, like paper boats which the mysterious current might sweep out into the open seas of life. One day, however, his attention was arrested by a familiar contour, a pair of bright prominent eyes, and a chin insufficiently shaved. He sprang up and stood in the path of Peter McCarran. The journalist looked at him doubtfully, then held out his hand with a startled deprecating, "Why, you didn't know me. I'm so changed." Grannis faltered, feeling the rebound of the other's wonder. "Why, no, but you're looking quieter smoothed out," McCarran smiled. "Yes, that's what I'm here for, to rest. And I've taken the opportunity to write out a clearer statement." Grannis's hand shook, so that he could hardly draw the folded paper from his pocket. As he did so, he noticed that the reporter was accompanied by a tall man with grave, compassionate eyes. It came to Grannis in a wild thrill of conviction that this was the face he had waited for. "Perhaps your friend he is your friend? Would glance over it, or I could put the case in a few words, if you have time." Grannis's voice shook like his hand. If this chance escaped him, he felt that his last hope was gone. McCarran and the stranger looked at each other, and the former glanced at his watch. "I'm sorry we can't stay and talk it over now, Mr. Grannis, but my friend has an engagement, and we're rather pressed." Grannis continued to proffer the paper. "I'm sorry, I think I could have explained. But you will take this, at any rate?" The stranger looked at him gently. "Certainly I'll take it." He had his hand out. "Goodbye." "Goodbye," Grannis echoed. He stood watching the two men move away from him through the long light hall, and as he watched them a tear ran down his face. But as soon as they were out of sight he turned, and walked hastily toward his room, beginning to hope again, already planning a new statement. Outside the building the two men stood still, and the journalist's companion looked up curiously at the long monotonous rows of barred windows. "So that was Grannis?" "Yes, that was Grannis, poor devil," said McCarran. "Strange case. I suppose there's never been one just like it? He's still absolutely convinced that he committed that murder?" "Absolutely. Yes," the stranger reflected. "And there was no conceivable ground for the idea? No one could make out how it started? A quiet, conventional sort of fellow like that, where do you suppose he got such a delusion? Did you ever get the least clue to it?" McCarran stood still, his hands in his pockets, his head cocked up in contemplation of the barred windows. Then he turned his bright, hard gaze on his companion. "That was the queer part of it. I've never spoken of it, but I did get a clue. By Jove! That's interesting. What was it?" McCarran formed his red lips into a whistle. High that it wasn't a delusion. He produced his effect. The other turned on him with a pallid stare. "He murdered the man all right. I tumbled on the truth by the merest accident, when I'd pretty nearly chucked the whole job." "He murdered and murdered his cousin?" "Sure as you live. Only don't split on me. It's about the queerest business I ever ran into. Do about it? Why, what was I to do? I couldn't hang the poor devil, could I? Lord, but I was glad when they collared him, and had him stowed away safe in there." The tall man listened with a grave face, grasping Grannis's statement in his hand. "Here, take this. It makes me sick," he said abruptly, thrusting the paper at the reporter. And the two men turned and walked in silence to the gates. The end. The Dilettante, as first published in Harper's Monthly, December 1903, it was on an impulse, hardly needing the arguments he found himself advancing in its favor, that Thursdale, on his way to the club, turned as usual into Mrs. Vervain's street. The "as usual" was his own qualification of the act. A convenient way of bridging the interval in days and other sequences that lay between this visit and the last. It was characteristic of him that he instinctively excluded his call 2 days earlier, with Ruth Gaynor, from the list of his visits to Mrs. Vervain. The special conditions attending it had made it no more like a visit to Mrs. Vervain than an engraved dinner invitation is like a personal letter. Yet it was to talk over his call with Miss Gaynor that he was now returning to the scene of that episode. And it was because Mrs. Vervain could be trusted to handle the talking over as skillfully as the interview itself that, at her corner, he had felt the dilettante's irresistible craving to take a last look at a work of art that was passing out of his possession. On the whole, he knew no one better fitted to deal with the unexpected than Mrs. Vervain. She excelled in the rare art of taking things for granted, and Thursdale felt a pardonable pride in the thought that she owed her excellence to his training. Early in his career, Thursdale had made the mistake, at the outset of his acquaintance with a lady, of telling her that he loved her, and exacting the same avowal in return. The latter part of that episode had been like a long walk back from a picnic, when one has to carry all the crockery one has finished using. It was the last time Thursdale ever allowed himself to be encumbered with the debris of a feast. He thus incidentally learned that the privilege of loving her is one of the least favors that a charming woman can accord, and in seeking to avoid the pitfalls of sentiment he had developed a science of evasion in which the woman of the moment became a mere implement of the game. He owed a great deal of delicate enjoyment to the cultivation of this art. The perils from which it had been his refuge became naively harmless. Was it possible that he who now took his easy way along the levels had once preferred to gasp on the raw heights of emotion? Youth is a high-colored season, but he had the satisfaction of feeling that he had entered earlier than most into that chiaroscuro of sensation, where every half-tone has its value. As a promoter of this pleasure, no one he had known was comparable to Mrs. Vervain. He had taught a good many women not to betray their feelings, but he had never before had such fine material to work in. As he had been surprisingly crude when he first knew her, capable of making the most awkward inferences, of plunging through thin ice, of recklessly undressing her emotions. But she had acquired, under the discipline of his reticences and evasions, a skill almost equal to his own, and perhaps more remarkable in that it involved keeping time with any tune he played, and reading at sight some uncommonly difficult passages. It had taken Thursdale 7 years to form this fine talent, but the result justified the effort. At the crucial moment, as he had been perfect, her way of greeting Miss Gaynor had made him regret that he had announced his engagement by letter. It was an evasion that confessed a difficulty, a deviation implying an obstacle, where, by common consent, it was agreed to see none. It betrayed, in short, a lack of confidence in the completeness of his method. It had been his pride never to put himself in a position which had to be quitted, as it were, by the back door. But here, as he perceived, the main portals would have opened for him of their own accord. All this, and much more, he read in the finished naturalness with which Mrs. Vervain had met Miss Gaynor. He had never seen a better piece of work. There was no over-eagerness, no suspicious warmth, above all, and this gave her art the grace of a natural quality. There were none of those damnable implications whereby a woman, in welcoming her friend's betrothed, may keep him on pins and needles while she laps the lady in complacency. So masterly a performance, indeed, hardly needed the offset of Miss Gaynor's doorstep words, "Oh, be so kind to me, how she must have liked you." Though he caught himself wishing it lay within the bounds of fitness to transmit them as a final tribute to the one woman he knew who was unfailingly certain to enjoy a good thing. It was perhaps the one drawback to his new situation, that it might develop good things which it would be impossible to hand on to Margaret Vervain. The fact that he had made the mistake of underrating his friend's powers, the consciousness that his writing must have betrayed his distrust of her efficiency, seemed an added reason for turning down her street instead of going on to the club. He would show her that he knew how to value her. He would ask her to achieve with him a feat infinitely rarer and more delicate than the one he had appeared to avoid. Incidentally, he would also dispose of the interval of time before dinner. Ever since he had seen Miss Gaynor off, an hour earlier, on her return journey to Buffalo, he had been wondering how he should put in the rest of the afternoon. It was absurd, how he missed the girl. Yes, that was it. The desire to talk about her was, after all, at the bottom of his impulse, to call on Mrs. Vervain. It was absurd, if you like, but it was delightfully rejuvenating. He could recall the time when he had been afraid of being obvious. Now he felt that this return to the primitive emotions might be as restorative as a holiday in the Canadian woods. And it was precisely by the girl's candor, her directness, her lack of complications, that he was taken. The sense that she might say something rash at any moment was positively exhilarating. If she had thrown her arms about him at the station, he would not have given a thought to his crumpled dignity. It surprised Thursdale to find what freshness of heart he brought to the adventure, and though his sense of irony prevented his ascribing his intactness to any conscious purpose, he could but rejoice in the fact that his sentimental economies had left him such a large surplus to draw upon. Mrs. Vervain was at home as usual. When one visits the cemetery, one expects to find the angel on the tombstone, and it struck Thursdale as another proof of his friend's good taste that she had been in no undue haste to change her habits. The whole house appeared to count on his coming. The footman took his hat and overcoat as naturally as though there had been no lapse in his visits, and the drawing room at once enveloped him in that atmosphere of tacit intelligence which Mrs. Vervain imparted to her very furniture. It was a surprise that, in this general harmony of circumstances, Mrs. Vervain should herself sound the first false note. "You," she exclaimed, and the book she held slipped from her hand. It was crude, certainly, unless it were a touch of the finest art. The difficulty of classifying it disturbed Thursdale's balance. "Why not?" he said, restoring the book. "SN apostrophe T at my hour?" And as she made no answer, he added gently, "Unless it's someone else's?" She laid the book aside and sank back into her chair. "I'm merely," she said. "I hope that doesn't mean that you're unwilling to share it with you?" "By no means. You're welcome to my last crust." He looked at her reproachfully. "Oh, you call this the last?" She smiled as he dropped into the seat across the hearth. "Tea's a way of giving it more flavor." He returned the smile. "Visit to you doesn't need such condiments." She took this with just the right measure of retrospective amusement. "Ah, but I want to put into this one a very special taste," she confessed. Her smile was so confident, so reassuring, that it lulled him into the imprudence of saying, "Why should you want it to be different from what was always so perfectly right?" She hesitated. "Isn't the fact that it's the last constitute a difference? The last, my last visit to you? Oh, metaphorically, I mean there's a break in the continuity." Decidedly, she was pressing too hard. "Unlearning his arts already. I don't recognize it," he said. "Unless you make me," he added, with a note that slightly stirred her attitude of languid attention. She turned to him with grave eyes. "You recognize no difference whatever?" "None except an added link in the chain." "An added link?" "In having one more thing to like you for, your letting Miss Gaynor see why I had already so many." He flattered himself that this turn had taken the least hint of fatuity from the phrase. Mrs. Vervain sank into her former easy pose. "Is it that you came for?" she asked, almost gaily. "If it is necessary to have a reason, that was one." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.